Well, good afternoon. My name is Pat Crew, and I have the pleasure to interview Mr. Dick Cooper of the Cooper family of Shenandoah Valley. And we're sitting out here on a gorgeous day on the patio, having a little snack and a glass of red wine. And we're starting off with Dick is talking about his great-grandfather was Dr. George Proctor Cooper, who came in 1919 from San Francisco. So, Dick, thank you again for welcoming us here. And some questions I go, do you know why he chose Amador County?
Well, yeah, he actually had set up a practice in Angels Camp, and he was worked for PG&E as they were building their hydro system then, Camp 9 and Camp 6 or something,
right.
You know. And he was also a pioneer in industrial safety too. That was one of his very early causes. He saw too many people getting hurt. And so he pioneered that. He was a brilliant man. But he had this established practice in Angels Camp. And he wanted to get away once in a while somewhere. And so he wanted to raise walnuts. So he took a correspondence course from the University of California on growing walnuts. And he put the word out amongst the foothill counties that he was looking for a piece of property that would grow walnuts. And this man found him, Mr. Dillon, who's just our neighbor, he's long since passed, but is our neighbor just up the road, and he found this piece of property, which is the original Cooper Ranch, which is
where we're
on
sitting
the
today.
Hill. No, that's up on that hill right over there. That mound up there. He bought that piece and planted the walnuts up there, and that's the home ranch.
Okay.
And this Mr. Dillon found it, and I have the deed at home, and it talks about one white horse, two goats, $12 a piece for the goats. The horse was $100, and it was, I don't know, $60 an acre for 210 acres. And this caretaker had lived there, and the guy sums up and he says, I think that takes care of everything, but I don't know how to get rid of the Portuguese.
In the deed.
So wow. Anyway, he ended up with that, and they planted walnuts up there. And I think his agricultural skills were kind of lacking because he put a lot of sheep on the ground and didn't use any fertilizer, and they sheeped it to death. And then along comes the winter rains, and they got a lot of soil erosion, so they had to put in contour ditching all the way around, you know, just the contours to deliver the water to the
plant
arroyos.
Oh, okay.
No, just to keep it from washing out.
Yeah.
So my grandfather, he passed on about 1942 or 3, and left the ranch to my father to run, and the first thing my dad did was
My dad
is Henry Field Cooper.
Henry Field Cooper.
Yeah.
All right. All right.
Has arrived. So she's getting everything ready, and I thought I would just sit this out here for you guys.
Thank you
all
so
right.
Much.
Great.
Thanks, Barbara.
Okay.
Thank you.
All
right. So they came around 1919, and they settled on what is called the home ranch. This is the dock. And was the ranch an income source, or did he?
No, it was a getaway.
Okay.
It was more of a hobby.
He
came
then.
Over.
So he was still doing the industrial medicine and working for PG&E.
When
they moved over here.
They didn't even actually move here. It was a weekend place.
Oh,
Sunday.
Okay.
And they drove over here. I remember they had something like a 41 Pontiac or something that they drove. And my grandma Cooper always had she called it a grub box. And there was always some cookies in there for us kids and, you know, on the various and sundry things she needed to make lunch. It was that was the grub box.
Wherever it happened to be. Huh?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. But my grandfather died young of prostate cancer, and so he wasn't able to, you know, complete his his life like he would have liked to.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, all they did was just open you up and cut it out of there, and that was that. And he always told my dad, he said, it's so painful, I wish I never had to let him cut on me. I'd have just rather left it alone. You know, but they didn't know, you know, then. There's a set of operating tools up there in that old house, operating knife and operating table from his era. And the operating knives are like about, like, the blades are like 10 inches long. And they have serrated handles. And this is what they operated on people with. You know, now they just use little scalpels, you know. So anyway, but that was then and this is now. Mm-hmm. But he was a brilliant man. That home up there where Jerry Ellen lives, he built that. Doc Cooper built it. He had two guys up there, Italian men, that were skilled in manual, you know, labor and things. Mm-hmm. And they built this log home up there, and it took them, I think, 3 years. And obtained the logs from actually the Pat Dillon Ranch up there, and brought them down from Dillon's, I think, in a flume. And then there was a ditch around the back of the hill, that hill, and I think the logs came around the back of the hill. And then they rolled them out. There was a knoll behind that house, and they ramped off that hill these big, long logs, and then dropped them into place. Boom. You know, and then they piked them around and made them sit where they were supposed to.
Really?
How did they do it without any loading or anything? Loaders and... And he told me they just rolled them out there. They did the foundation. And he actually, my grandfather had built a willow stick model of the home. And it was about the size of this table. And
of that's how he wanted it to look.
How he wanted it to look. There's a ridge log, I think it's 56 feet long, that goes all the way through the center of the house. And it's just right there. And he made little concrete fireplaces in there. And that model's still up there in the house, in the basement.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and, you know, it's funny because, you know, history repeats itself. When I got down to the fair and I wanted to put a new front on the main exhibit building with those four windows in it,
yep.
I thought, I'm going to go down to the shop and I'm going to build a model like my grandpa did. And I had the scale and everything, and I worked all one night or two nights on it. But it was all finished, and it had the roof pitches and everything I wanted and everything else, and I gave it to Mervyn Valvo, and I said, here, this is the model. This is, build it from this.
Wow.
You see?
Yeah.
You learn, everything goes around, comes around, you know?
Yep. All that's old is new again.
So anyway, that ultimately... I moved into that house. There was a small home on the ranch.
That's where you were raised?
Up there, yeah, raised on that hill.
Your father?
With my dad and my mom. And my
your
sister.
Mom's name?
Ruth Elizabeth Cooper. She was a Deaver. Ruth Elizabeth Deaver Cooper.
All right.
That's the tie-in there.
And Henry was... How many children did George have?
Dr. Cooper?
Yeah, the brothers and sisters of Henry.
Yeah. George, a dentist in Angel's Camp.
All right.
Elizabeth, who was a physical therapist and married an Army colonel. And so that was what her family was. She had that family in it. And then... my Uncle Bob, Robert M. Cooper, and he was a criminalist in Alameda County. He studied criminology at University of California, Berkeley, during the Korean War. I remember I went down to visit him for a weekend, and they had a picture of Korea and everything and pins and everything, and they were following the Korean War from his... dormitory room in his buddy.
Yeah.
And that's how I know that was the time. And he was actually, you know, the those guys that stole that school bus and kidnapped those kids?
I do.
Down there?
Or in Turlock or Tulare or something. Yeah.
Well, my uncle was the first one down on that bus. Nobody wanted to get in that bus, you know, because they were afraid it would collapse, you know, and they knew the kids were in there.
Or booby trapped.
My uncle said, give me a goddamn ladder, I'll get in the bus. So he was the first one. He just passed away about 6 months ago. It's a real loss to our family because Uncle Bob, he's the last connection to that generation.
Uh-huh. So there were five of them?
Four.
And see,
Bob.
Oh, yeah, I was counting your mother. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
George the dentist, Liz, and Robert.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And he was the last one to still live. He was just passed. Okay.
Yeah.
Then it comes down to you, but the ranch that your grandfather he wanted to raise walnuts. Did he ever do that?
He did.
Oh, he did.
He did. Yeah, they cleaned off a lot of manzanita brush, and they planted walnut trees up there. And those walnut trees are there today on that hill up there. There's about, I think, 110 acres of walnuts. My sister inherited that ranch from my dad. And she raises the walnuts. And then my dad bought this ranch in 1958. And he
You're
left
leading
this
to the next logical question. How did this happen? Yeah. So this was your father bought the Cooper Ranch that we know today.
Yeah.
Well, not the one you...
He bought it from Norma Ball. He always referred to it out of respect to Mrs. Ball, that it was the Ball Ranch.
Uh-huh.
But now if you say Ball Ranch, nobody knows what you're talking about.
That was in 1958?
Yes.
And there were no grapes on it at that time? It was just bare ground?
No, there was 35 acres of prunes right here.
Oh, okay.
And there was some walnuts, but it was mainly a prune and walnut and pasture venture deal. And so a lot of the pasture, I wanted to put in grapes years ago, and my dad said, I'll help you with 5 acres of grapes, but I don't want any more grapes on this ranch. I won't participate in any more grapes.
Really?
And the reason...
Thought it was a fool's venture?
Yeah, because in world, he and my uncle Ken Deaver, my mom's brother, had leased the ranch from Aunt Mary Davis, which is a rifle shot right through there that now Kenny Deaver owns most of it. That's Grandma Davis's ranch.
Okay.
And she had 40 acres of Zinfandel grapes and a few muscats. And so they had always taken care of it. Or they had leased it from Aunt Mary. They took care of it with an old Cat 15 tractor and a 5-foot Kilifer disc and a Model A truck. I remember all that. And the government was buying grapes to make alcohol out of because World War II was on and they were using it in the military hospitals, keeping guys alive, you know, because it was antiseptic, you know.
Oh, okay.
And so they were, so, but the soonest World War II was, and they were getting like $125 a ton, which was really a good price then. Well, the minute the war was over, the price dropped to $25 a ton.
Mm-hmm.
So, bango. And they had a whole crop of grapes out there. And so anyway, they took a bath on that. And they did have some backup customers down in Sacramento, down on P Street and Q Street down there by where the railroad track is, and they took a lot of grapes down there, but they had too many for that market, and the only other market was Enrico D'Agostini Wine, Mr. the D'Agostini family, right up the road, and they set the price, and the price, it was either $25 or nothing, and we're going to charge you $10 a ton to haul them.
Yeah, that's just the way life goes in those
days,
huh?
So that's why my dad. Hi, Mike. That's why my dad didn't want any more to do with grapes.
I see.
But then the reason we got into Barbera is Dad asked Daryl Cordy at a house party. My mom and dad used to have nice party, dinner parties, you know, and they liked all the people in the wine business. And you're a propane guy.
Yeah.
Thanks,
yeah.
Mike.
Thank you. We're getting a little ahead of ourselves. We want
we'll come back to
we're
that.
We're going to bet the big finish is the king of Barbara.
Oh, okay. All right.
You were born, were there even hospital? I know I was born in Stockton.
I was born in Angels Camp.
Angels Camp.
Angels Camp. And my grandfather was the doctor. And I was born in Bonnie Baritono's maternity home.
Almost every little town had one.
Yeah.
Midwives, yeah.
Yeah, and actually, they bought the Baritono's pass. Thanks, Mike. They bought the Baritono property is now where that big Catholic church is located on the left side as you go into Angels Camp.
Yeah, St.
Okay.
Patrick's.
Yeah, okay, that's where the Baritono's. That's the Baritono.
That was their home?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, cool. But you moved to this ranch?
Yeah. Let's see. My dad was working at that time as a brakeman on the, I think, Western Pacific Railroad.
Okay.
And because there weren't a lot of jobs around when he got out of school. And he worked for a while at the Walnut Growers Association in Linden, when that was the biggest. That was the biggest receiving plant. That was Walnut. That was Diamond Central right then at that time.
Okay.
And so he worked there, but then he got a job working for the railroad, and they hauled melons out of Firebaugh all the way up and over the summit, and he had great stories about the extra engines they'd put on to get over the Sierra and,
yeah,
you know, and all that. And they'd come back, you know, empty or something and then just fly. And, but he made the railroad was kind of an adventure for him. And he stayed in touch with a lot of his engineer friends and so forth, you know, as life went on, they'd come by and visit, you know, and it's the kind of thing that gets in your blood, you know.
And so you lived in Angels Camp for your first...
The first part, but we lived in Tracy. Then we moved to Tracy.
Okay,
you know, this is before I can remember anything. I think we lived in Tracy to be near the railroad, because that was the mustering center. You know, he would get his orders. Yeah. Tracy was a head thing for the trains, I guess. And so we lived down there for about a year and a half, and then my grandfather passed away at that time, or he made a deal with my dad to come up and run the farm, to come up and take care of that.
So that was the transition.
Yeah, it was
some
a transition.
Some big event happened.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we moved to a little, my mom always called it the shack, but I mean, I was always real comfortable there, but it was like it was four rooms and a sleeping porch and no concrete foundation, built on rocks. You know, the lizards would come and go.
They don't eat much.
I mean, I thought it was a great place, you know. But and then actually, then after when I started out, I got married. Well, I thought it was a great place to live, you know. And my wife, Susie, hated it because, you know, it's just there were frogs in the shower and, you know, and all that kind of stuff. And she grew up in Sacramento. So it was not...
So did you have any siblings?
Yep, my sister Bonnie.
Okay.
And
that's right. You mentioned her and
Bonnie Cooper and Winther and she and I grew up there and we
in
got
the
along.
Shack. You
in
got,
the shack. In the shack. Shack. Yeah. I remember we got electricity in 1947. I remember there was the PG&E brought in electricity, 1947, because I remember my Uncle Ken Deaver got married, and he and Bobby Deaver went to Detroit, Michigan, and picked up a 47 Plymouth sedan.
At the factory?
At the factory.
Wow.
And so I remember 1947, and when the PG&E guy came and switched us on, he told my mom, he said, well, You got power. You can just leave your lights on all night long now.
Wow.
And we had a little generator out in the washroom, and it's so small by standards today. You know, this little darn generator. I don't know what it was. Something like maybe 85 watts or less. You know, and single cylinder. And but if we'd have company, you know, my dad would always fill it up with gasoline. And then we'd have our fried chicken. A Judge Celia Sherwood from Plymouth would always come to our house on Sunday night and for chicken dinner. That was Celia. She was a wonderful woman, and she played the piano, and her son was a musician.
A woman judge. That's unusual in that era, isn't it?
Oh yeah, yeah. Well, she was very competent, and her offices was right in the back of the city hall. And I would always run up and see Celia, you know, whenever we went to Plymouth. And anyway, Dad would go out and start this generator. And we'd be eating dinner, and we'd have, you know, one or two 50-watt lights there, and we'd eat. And he always had a candle on or a flashlight handy, and pretty soon the generator would go pop, 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 pop. That was all over. And yeah. That's when everybody went home.
It's time to go, yeah. So you went to school? Did you go to the
right
Shenandoah
here, Shenandoah school?
School?
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. My grandmother was a teacher, Elizabeth Davis.
She was the teacher,
mm-hmm.
Which again ties back to the Davis Ranch, which
right.
is a stone's throw over there.
Yes, yes.
So that was the school on the edge of their property.
I think the school. I think actually Ken Deaver owns one side, and I don't know. The place where we all park belongs to Ken Deaver. I don't know where that school has been there since 1880.
Yeah.
You know, that big old white wooden school.
There was an article in the Amadorian about that. That was in the Williams District at the time before it was the Shenandoah Valley.
Is that what they call it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember the name Davis from reading that, but I couldn't remember whether they donated part to the school or. Because all these little schools were built by the people around.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was through eighth grade?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then you had to go to the county
high school. Yeah,
huh?
Yeah. I think, I can't remember if I did not. I think I was the last student that finished school there. The next year, they had the seventh and eighth graders go into Plymouth.
Right.
Because they consolidated the elementary. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
That was in that article.
So what year
was that?
Well, let's see. I graduated high school in 57.
All right.
So let's subtract 54? 4 from that. 54.
Yeah, 5, 6. No, 53.
So 53. Yeah. Graduated in 1953.
Then you went to, was it Sutter Creek High School then?
Amador.
It was
Amador. Right. Yeah, yeah.
Hi,
Terry. Do you know Michelle?
I do.
Michelle Fox. Yeah.
The tire reader.
Yes.
That's right. So 1957.
Yeah.
Now we're your father's. You had inherited the ranch by then.
No. My dad ran a ranch.
He was running it, and you just helped.
Yeah, I helped. At the time,
was that as much of an interest to you?
Through my high school years,
at 18, as it is today, or
oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I
always wanted to.
Raked hay at 12 years old. I had a driver's license when I was 14. I had a Model A Roadster. I knew how to time it, how to tune it up, and you know, I always loved the farm. I worked a lot for Grandpa Davis over on the Davis Ranch, which was the original Deaver Ranch. It was original Davis. My grandfather Deaver passed on early. He had a bad heart. That's Ken Deaver's father.
Where the Deaver Ranch now is was the Davis Ranch.
Was Joe Davis?
Oh,
yeah.
So they're really intertwined. The
yeah,
Davis and
yeah.
the Deaver.
Well, yeah, Joe. Because when my grandfather died, Joe Davis married Elizabeth Deaver, and then they had a child. Mary Eleanor Davis Cowan. You know Mary Eleanor Cowan.
Yeah. I know Rob.
Rob. Yeah. That's Rob's mom.
Right, yeah.
And I always thought I always thought, or I heard, that Grandpa Davis and Grandpa Deaver were in a gold mine, partners in a gold mine, because Grandpa Davis was a Teamster.
Uh-huh.
But somebody else told me they didn't know that. So, thanks, kids.
Wow, thank you. They're bringing us a great lunch here while we're... Okay. Cool.
And Blondie says thanks. And Blondie, yeah, look at her.
She's got her own bag of jerky somewhere. Barbara's
okay.
Got it.
And nice. Then, this is some of our
is that our olive oil?
All right, well, we've solved the heat problem. I think we've licked hunger for the day. So when we quit, we were talking about we got pretty much the lineage of the Coopers. And now Dick has graduated from high school. It's 1957. Works on the ranch. Had aspirations. And what happened after that? After high school?
I went to Davis. Big school, even though it was like only... I forgot how many people were down there, only a fraction of what's there now. But I was probably not really prepared to go to Davis because high school had always been pretty easy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went down there and I thought, well, I'll just slide through, I guess. Well, I had to study, you know. And there was a lot of guys there that were war veterans, and they were there to learn. I mean, they weren't there to party, and they weren't there to drink beer, and they weren't there to be in a fraternity. They studied. And anyway, I did pretty well down there. I just lasted 2 years. I took all the 1A courses and the 5 courses, and like viticulture 1A. Chem 1A.
The stuff you thought would be practical.
Soils 1.
That you would be able to use in taking over the ranch.
Yeah, botany,
uh-huh.
Biology, agronomy. I just loaded up on those, but I had some great professors and learned a lot and listened a lot. And I just... Some of my professors are just some of the immortal greats now, you know, like Dr. Cole, animal husbandry from Dr. Cole,
mm-hmm.
Viticulture from Lloyd Leiter, who then became chancellor of the university, Professor Maynard Amerine. I'm having a mental blank, but it's the science of winemaking. He's the guy that invented Opus 1. And he was my professor
uh-huh.
down there. And so, and even in my fraternity, I was able to room with, you want to get in the truck? Go ahead. You can get in the truck. I'll say, what's this doing on the tape? But anyway, my dog is looking like she wants to get in the truck.
Yeah.
Anyway, I roomed with John Franzia. You know, now he owns Bronco Cellars. And he was from Franzia Wines.
The Franzia family.
Yeah, and they sold Coca-Cola, I think. I always thought it was PepsiCo, but I think a Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
They sold a Coca-Cola. And then I think he and his cousin, Frank, started Bronco Cellars. And I think his mom was a Gallo.
Okay.
Mrs. Franzia, John's mother, was a
uh-huh.
Gallo. An advisor to our fraternity was Pete Christensen, who was the grape farm advisor to Fresno County. Nice guy.
Uh-huh.
So I had all these grapes around me, and I just listened to what they said.
And you took advantage by paying attention, yeah.
Yeah.
Good. So,
you know, I just... For some reason, I never did forget what somebody said about growing grapes. I always remembered. There's just something about grapes that I just always...
It clicked with you.
It clicked with me, yeah.
It didn't click with your father from his experiences.
Yeah.
5 acres top, that's it.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So that ends 2 years at Davis. And we come back to Shenandoah Valley?
Came back to Amador County, started a little gardening service because there wasn't one. And I was kind of looking about for something to do.
Like lawns and landscapes?
Scheduled landscape,
yeah. Okay.
And I got to know Al Thompson. We planted the first Little League grass in Jackson for the Rotary Club way, way, way back.
The original incarnation of the Little League Park,
which
the Rancheria just overhauled for
it. Yeah. And we did the best we could planting that. I didn't know everything about planting a lawn. But my big mistake was we used peat moss on the infield and on to cover the seed, you know. And then on the outfield, we used straw, you know, old farmer deal. You know, it came up good, but it messed up the lawnmower, so they couldn't cut the grass because wild up in the lawnmower.
Yeah.
So either they or we, I think the Rotary Club did, went out and just on a work day, raked all the straw off. Oh, my God.
Well, that started a long history with the Rotary Club, which we'll go into later. But
Al Thompson was really great, and he taught me how to draw landscaping symbols and how to do landscape plans. Al Thompson, you know, is a brilliant artist.
Yeah.
And armed with that, I just went ahead and got more into the landscaping deal and started a family. And then my yard maintenance thing was doing pretty well. We were taking care of everybody who was anybody's lawn, I think. Pierce Deasy, Judge Ralph McGee,
Franklin Denary.
Yep. Right up and down the line.
Yeah.
But then I found out that I couldn't make enough money mowing lawns. Jerry Dillion was my partner in a business, and we just couldn't make enough money to really make it pay. You know, I couldn't feed a family on it.
Right.
But it was, we just tried and tried and tried. And I remember we used to finish the day, Thursdays or whatever day it was, mowing Tibby Spinetta's lawn, and then going up to the Jackson dump. And I had an old pickup, and we'd fork out all the grass at the Jackson dump, and we did
up Tibby, on the hill there.
On the hill,
yeah.
And we did Tibby's last because there were street lights, so we could see with those street lights. And one time we were coming down from that dump, and we always took the grab a bite, Teresa. You feel like
I don't want to interrupt.
Okay.
I'm going to go back down to the house.
Okay.
If you need anything else, Michelle will be glad to help you. And,
I think we're
okay.
Great shape.
Thanks very much.
Okay.
That's super nice job.
Nice to meet you, too.
So, anyway, we'd always take the spare tire. Had an old 55 Ford pickup. Put the spare tire on top of the
cab,
you know, the roof.
Yeah.
Well, one night we forgot it in the dark. We leave the dump. We're going down the hill to Jackson or Sutter Creek, wherever that road goes down to. Off comes the hood, the tire off the roof, hits the hood, and goes down the road. Rolling down the road, we had to speed up to chase that.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then about the time I think I had run up as much credit as I could with the grocer locally, the county. And still no relief in sight, you know. So, but still trying. But God provides. And Amador County, advertised for an agricultural inspector. And said, you know, and somebody told me that I should apply for that job. And I thought, well, what can I do with my gardening business too, you know? But I thought, well, I owe this money, and this gardening business isn't getting it. So,
yeah.
I applied for the job, and I got it. And I worked. The agriculture commissioner was a great guy named Leland Brown, and he told me, he says, "Dick, this position is not held in very high esteem." So he says, "It will be what you make it." Mm-hmm. And that was that. And so I just really got involved, and they have certificates. You have to take tests and stuff. And I think there was 11 certificates then, and I was studying, and I was passing them two at a time and three at a time. The easier ones three at a time, the harder ones two at a time.
You think your Davis background helped you there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And they provided study material too, but you know what I mean? I'm not bragging, but I kind of developed a reputation around the state because you got this wonder boy up there. You know, who is he? And then Lee Brown used to take me to the commissioners' meetings. And I just sat and minded my own business. And here I was sitting there with a ag commissioner from Yolo County, Herb Chandler, and up and down the state. And I knew all these guys, and it was wonderful.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I just got to just sit in those meetings and absorb all that knowledge. It was great. It was a great, great start. And then
so that was probably, what, 61?
Yeah.
In the area. 57,
yeah. And then Lee Brown got a chance to go back up to Wheatland, I think, one of those counties up in the North Sacramento Valley.
Yeah.
And he told me, he says, "Dick, I hate to leave Amador County, but this is like going home." And I just cried.
Yeah, losing your best friend kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
And he was such a professional, but he never had to box my ears about anything either. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was wonderful what I learned from that man. And the opportunities they provided for me. And, oh, anyway, then, so he left and they didn't have an agriculture commissioner in the county for a while. And so I was the acting ag commissioner. And so here I am at 23, acting ag commissioner, you know. And the ag commissioner, you know, I just did what he did, you know, kind of stayed on top of things and, you know, drove the truck around. And there are certain things you're supposed to do. One of the things that the agricultural commissioner is he has to render a report to the supervisors on the condition of agriculture in Amador County.
And I was leading to a question, a quick aside. So you gave up the landscape business?
Pretty much.
Because that was a full-time job. Getting those certificates, you just didn't have time to do it.
I was studying. I was staying up nights, and I was just studying hard, you know.
You and your wife and Jennifer here,
the
oldest daughter was here, so yeah, you needed a full-time job.
Yeah. But it was really good, and I had something I was thinking of. Oh, and Harold Coburn was on the board of supervisors then?
Yeah, you had to report to the supervisors on the condition of agriculture.
And I knew what was going on, and there was sugar beets out down on Baymerts and hadn't been harvested yet, and you know what I mean. So I did this whole thing, the sugar beets are in the ground, and blah, 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 blah. And by golly, Harold Coburn wrote a, he used to have the Coburn's Corner or whatever it was in the newspaper. And by golly, he said that, you know, Dick Cooper is acting ag is a bright star, acting agriculture commissioner, gave us the best report on agriculture in Amador County that we've ever heard. So, you know, neat. I mean, it was great. So anyway, then from there.
So that's agriculture 50 years ago in Amador County in the early 60s.
Yep.
Grapes were...
Not a big deal. Cattle,
the biggest crop.
Cattle was forestry was the biggest.
Forestry was the biggest.
In dollars, yeah.
But, and then cattle raised,
yep.
And then...
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, then the fair... The fair, Goolawait, said, "Dick, we need a livestock superintendent. Do you think you could work it in your schedule to be our livestock superintendent?" And I said, "Oh, Gula, I don't know. You know, it's just like, I'm just busy and I don't know if I can." And she said, "Well, I'll talk to Mr. Colburn and maybe he can arrange for some time off from the county for you to come and help us out at the fair.
Right, because it's not just the 4 days of the fair to be the livestock superintendent.
Yeah. So I tried it, and the first year I was there, we had a rain on two nights before the fair or the night before the fair. It just drenched. It must have rained 5 inches overnight. Oh, my God.
At 65 or 6?
I think so.
Yeah. You couldn't get away from it.
Yeah. And so, anyway, she said, Dick, I want you to come to the board of directors meeting with me. So we go to the board of directors meeting, and here's Harold Colburn, Fred Guise, Lucian Vira, Fred Spruance from Volcano, Les Panel, Ion, Walt Steiner, Shenandoah Valley. There was 9 of them. She says, I don't know what we're going to do, but she says, we're definitely going to have to requisition for more straw. And Dick Cooper says he can have it cleaned up if I can just get approval on some more money for straw. Well, you know, and they said, well, sure, Gula, go ahead, get more straw. What else can you do?
Yeah.
So I just went to work, and we just mucked out. I went to work at night as soon as we got the approval. I had a crew of 4 or 5 guys. We just mucked out that straw. And Eldon Waite was nice enough to bring a little Ford tractor with a little angle blade on the back. But we just sneaked in there and got that straw out, and we did it. We had a huge amount of straw, wet straw that we generated. Yeah. But by golly, we went right back in and cleaned her up, and the fair went on. And that was going to help me later, because the fair, Gula Waite retired to go to the fair's and expositions in Sacramento.
Yeah, she got a state job. Right?
Yes.
Uh-huh. How long was she the fair director?
Well, must have been for like 12 years.
Yeah, fairly long time.
Yeah, uh-huh, yeah.
But at that time, you're still only 25?
Yeah, 25 or 26.
Yeah.
Well, there was what was happening about that time is, you know, I think it's such a neat deal. I always got a chance to be with older people that were doing what I was doing.
Or what you sort of wanted to do.
Yeah. And all these fair managers got into business in 1939, with the Horse Racing Act of 1939 or 37, whenever it was, 38, and they were all original fair managers. Malcolm Hamill from Grass Valley, all these guys that are mature, you know, and I got to know them all, you know, and then there was this giant turnover of people because all these people
were the same age.
Yeah. They all got into business at the same time, and they all died at the same time, or they all retired at the same time. So anyway, the board of directors down here advertised for a secretary manager, and Gula told me, she says, Dick, I think you should apply. And I said, Gula, I'm not qualified to run this fair, you know. It's just, it would be a fool's errand. No, she said, you know, you have support on the board right now if you want. So there was like 22 or 25 people applied for the job, and lo and behold, I got it. And I thought, now what am I going to do? But
and the youngest fair manager in the state of California at the time or ever?
I don't know at the time.
Yeah, at the time you were.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like dog chasing cars. You finally caught one.
What
do you do now?
Yeah. But wow. You know, it was good because it was like my own little fiefdom down there. I if I wanted to make something nicer, I could. If I wanted to move some gravel, I knew how to run a loader. The back lot of the fairgrounds was pretty rough then. And L.M. Peary was the road manager for the county for this District 5, and he would leave loaders down there on a backhoe at the county yard, which was just across the street, full of fuel. And I'd go down and run them all night. And I got in trouble, though, because one night I took a loader back, and the county people jumped in it and took off the Fiddletown, and it ran out of fuel.
Oh.
He said, "Damn it, Dick, I don't care if you use that equipment. Just please fill it up."
Yeah, before they want to use it the next. I saw where that was going. But you told me a story that Gula Waite gave you a vision of the fair by taking you to Disneyland.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then that became your vision?
Yeah, I looked at what I was seeing at Disneyland and the colors that they used, and there's a close line between being cutesy and being nice
or classy.
Classy,
yeah.
You know,
right.
What
yeah.
people would think. And down at Disneyland, I saw that. I saw, you know, it's classy, but not cutesy.
Yeah.
And so I tried to maybe, and the other thing I thought that they did there, they would simplify things. Not, they wouldn't have little and intricate and little peachy. It's more of like a broad brush stroke for that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And then maybe a broad brush stroke around the corner. And the trees are different. And they make things different by a subliminal suggestion. Like if you go down a street that's got this kind of trees, and then you go turn the corner and there's another kind of trees and
you
shrubs.
You feel like you're in a different
place.
Yeah.
You know,
uh-huh.
And that's what I learned down at Disneyland by just trying to, and the cleanliness of the place.
Yeah, you've mentioned the cleanliness was.
Yeah.
And I
just found that out. I mean, I just carried that through with the Amador County Fair. I just said, we need more garbage cans. We need more people picking up trash. The people who are picking up trash need to look nicer. I mean, yeah, volunteers they may be, but let's get a basic uniform. Or something, you know, mm-hmm. a vest and a, you know, and a little dapper
and a,
hat,
and
you know,
a pride in their work,
right?
Yeah.
So anyway, and that lasted for about 6 years, and I got a chance to use all the ideas I had.
Uh huh.
Started the sawmill, got the windmill there, put a front on the main building.
Which the community foundation I told you is were. Retrofitting it.
Are you really?
The General Mercantile Building?
Yeah.
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 We're spending $30,000 on it to doll that up. So we're kind of just going down. Maybe we're repeating what you did,
you know, that
50
was,
years ago, but we're not changing
well,
a thing.
Fine.
It's
nothing's
the same
forever.
Windows. And
nothing's forever.
Like we're adding air conditioners.
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
For the, yeah, I mean, just little things.
I put
but
those,
your basic idea still works.
I put those swamp coolers in there And before that, nobody would go in that building because it was so hot, you
right.
know. But the swamp. I remember I wrote a thing. I used to write my own press, you know. So Monday nights I'd stay up all night long. I'd just write press. I'd just write things, stories. Stories that come to my mind. I was a lot brighter then than I am now. Then I would just so Sunday night I'd stay up all night long, or Monday night I'd stay up. I can't remember, but I think Monday night all night long. Write this stuff. Have my PR person come in. Type it and clean it up, and I'd have four or five articles ready to go out to the Ledger and the Dispatch. We had two papers in.
Right.
We had three for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The Ion Progress News.
Progress News, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that, too.
So it was really good, and you know, I could just do my ideas, but I think after 5 or 6 years, you're kind of used up, you know. You kind of don't have any, you kind of used it up, and then to politics with the fair board. I loved all those guys, but a couple of them just commented, well, you know, with Dick Cooper, he doesn't even need a board of directors because he just goes and does stuff. And,
uh-huh.
you know, and there's, but there's no point in me go and wring my hands and say, I just don't know what I need, what I can do, and I need some help here. If I figured I had the answer, I just went and did it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I mean, it was time. And I heard there was other fair managers, too, at the time that used to say the fair managers should rotate every 5 years. and take you to put you in Calaveras County, Titicaca, Calaveras County, and put him in.
Oh, I see.
You know what I mean?
So
and
not get, yeah, like you might have went to the Yolo County Fair.
Yeah.
Did
yeah.
you, or something like that.
I had a chance to go to Del Rey if I wanted to be an assistant manager. That, you know, that's a big horse racing fair. That's San Diego.
Oh, yeah.
But you know, I had a really nice reputation, but I thought, I've got my family here. I know, I like Amador County. I wouldn't know how to act anywhere else anyway. So, thank God for Amador County, or I would be, I don't know what I'd be, nothing probably.
Yeah. So, the fair's over. The ranch is not much has happened.
Oh, yeah, my dad.
He was still working it?
He was tired of it. And he says, I'm not making much money on this place. Why don't you lease it from me?
This ranch where we're sitting.
Yeah.
All right.
I said, okay, you know. Maybe.
After the fair, so then is that when you went into ranching full time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So your primary source of income was the
yeah.
ranch, right?
I took a cut in pay to come back to the ranch.
Yeah.
I was making $915 a month at the fair, and I was making $600 on working for my parents, and less when I leased it. But it's okay.
I got to work twice as many hours.
Yeah. My dad and my mom helped the kids too, though. They helped the kids in school and everything. So, yeah, I took out this prune orchard here. I tried making the prunes work, but the orchard was too old, and it just wasn't productive enough. And so I figured I just had to take them out. I was afraid it would hurt my dad's feelings by taking the prunes out, but I took them out, and he told me, he says, well, son, I'm surprised you kept them in as long as you did.
I was waiting for that to happen.
Yeah. I feel like saying, why didn't you tell me a long time ago?
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
crazy.
Well, you got to learn on yours. You learn. Yeah, I can just hear him say yeah. that. Wow.
And then I just brought with the things I learned from, like being at the fair. We did electrical renovations, and the engineers down there let me be the building inspector for the projects up here because they knew we could get things done and we wouldn't just siphon off the money, and I learned a lot about electrical, and you know, and because we pulled all new electricity up through the freeway there, up through the center thing, and redid that, and it made me, it just gave me all kinds of experience to be a winery owner or to build something like this. You know, or
yeah.
that. I mean, it's just like, hey, it's all nuts and bolts. You look at the plan, you size the wire, you check the fittings,
uh-huh.
you know, and
did you ever envision it to be what it is today when you first started?
No.
You were just going to grow some grapes and get rid of the prunes?
Yeah.
That was
yeah.
it. And there's yeah. a house on the property. Did you live here when you?
Yeah, there's a house down there, but my dad expanded it for me.
Okay.
And when I moved in, it had been a rental before, and it was built by the previous owners.
So when you leased the ranch, then that became your house.
Came with it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And we had Jennifer and
Rochelle
by then.
Yeah, Jerry Ellen.
Oh, it's
Jerry Ellen, and then Chrissy, who's actually a baby and grew up down
so
there.
So they
all grew up there.
All grew up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of a cool thing. You don't hear that very often.
They all ran out to the bus in the morning, and Ambrose had honked the horn, and they'd all run out there, and there was one that was always late. Oh, my God, I won't even mention her name. But she was always late to the bus. Always late. Could never find her jacket. Oh, I love you, honey. But can't you be there on time?
Where's but my lunch? I don't
Ambrose
know.
Ambrose would just blow the horn and wait.
Uh-huh.
You know, we just had there were such good people around there then. I don't know, I'm not saying there aren't good people now, but you know, when you know that bus driver and he's never missed a day of work in his waking life.
And he's never late.
And he's never late,
yeah.
And he's just a quality guy, you know.
Yeah, it's something, I'm sure if you ask them, they would say the same thing. They remember the same memories that you do. Yeah.
Oh, I did a little stint on bus driving too in the middle for a while. but I think that was while I was working for the Department of Agriculture. But you know what? I liked it. I love the kids, but it just got scary. There's so much responsibility. You know what I mean? And I didn't realize I had allergies as bad as I do. But because you know
that's
never,
not good for
you
a
never,
farmer.
No, but I mean, it's not good for a school bus driver either. When you're driving up to the town road and you can't keep your eyes open,
yeah.
You know, and you say to some eighth graders, "Hey, come on, talk to me. I want to stay awake." And then they sent me over to, when I told them I'd be a school bus driver, I said, "I don't want to go on any long night runs." You know what I mean? I'm not a professional driver. I just, you know, and they sent me to Somerville.
Oh,
that was it.
Back in the days before the bridge.
I said, no more. I said, I'm not going to do it. Well, they said, well, you have to take them when you're assigned. I said, then I'm done.
Yeah.
Now, what I want to mention, too, that my gardening business that I had, Chuck Simmons picked up the pieces on that, and that's how he got started.
Oh, is that right?
Yep.
Okay. So it was Jerry Dillion was your partner. He retired from the business same time.
Yeah,
you
we
did.
Split at the same time. And,
okay.
And we're great friends, but you know we just weren't making any money, and
it was just a job.
It was just a job, and you know he went off and got into construction and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But it was great. It was a nice feeling thing, and you know to be able to know all the people, all the attorneys and stuff, everybody, Angelo DePauli, and you know. People that we worked for. I mean, just right down the line.
Uh-huh.
It was nice to know them all and just to visit with them. T.B. Spinetta, she used to say to me, "Dickie, when you finish my yard, I want you to come in and sing a song." So I'd go into her kitchen and she'd have a Coke for me. She'd push it out there. She'd say, "Now sing me a song, Dickie." And I'd say, "What do you want to hear?" "How about Let Me Ride in Your Little Red Wagon?" And I said, okay.
Uh-huh.
So I stand right there in her kitchen, all the tile and everything all over, you know, it's old country and everything. "Won't you ride in my little red wagon?" And I'd sing the song.
Keep going.
She says, "I just love that song." Well, you know, I saw her. She passed, of course. You know, time goes by and we lose these people. But her son, not Lou, he died of a heart attack, but her other son, do you know? He's Michael Spinetti's father.
Oh, Spinetti's, you mean?
Get him mixed up.
Spinetti's. Gene.
Yeah, Gene Spinetti. Yeah. Well, I saw him down at Plymouth at the restaurant years ago. I went in and I said, "Hi, Gene, how are you?" He says, "Come on, you have a minute?" I said, "Sure." He said, "I want to tell you how much it means to me that you would come and sing to my mom after you cut her grass." He said, "You know, she doesn't have a very fancy life up there."
In the big brick house.
In the big brick house, you know.
On crossing high school then. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He says, "It just always meant a lot to me that you would do that. And it meant a lot to her and I wanted to tell you."
Uh-huh.
There you go, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing. I remember, it was Lou.
And he had a brother, too. But what was the brother that was in that business? Tony? I'm guessing now. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Frankie Tortorich used to work at Gordon Hill Nursery, too, along with Al Thompson and all of them. And Frankie Tortorich said, "You know, when I was working down there at Spinetta's, Louie would take a pocket knife, and when a broom was worn out, he'd take and cut the bottom three strings off of it and take those out and fluff that up and use it." And I said, "How do you think he got to own that store, Frankie?"
Well, Chuck Simmons got his start working for Spinetti, too, before he took over the landscape.
Really?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah, when he was a kid, he worked there. Yeah. Quite the family. I went to school with Michael.
Yeah.
So, that was our... So, I guess the obvious question, there's two things you're known for, three, actually. Number one is, I would ask, when you planted the grapes here, were they Zinfandel, your original?
No.
No?
Barbera.
It was Barbera? Because you are known as the king of Barbera.
You know, it all, it's like falling in a hole and coming up clean, you know.
So your commitment to Barbera started as soon as you started raising grape. You didn't just kind of experiment with different varietals and come back to
it? No. My dad, there was a dinner party up at the house, and Daryl Cordy was there. Mm-hmm. I think Scott Harvey was there. My mom and dad, they used to have parties a lot, and they would have people from the wine business. My mom told me, she says, we don't invite you to the parties up here, the dinners up here, because you're always working. Well, try me. I'd come up and eat. But anyway, my dad says, Cordy, what's a good black grape to grow in Shenandoah Valley and not Zinfandel?
Right, because that's what everybody grew.
Because that's what everybody grew, and that's what my dad got burned on, you know. So Cordy says, Barbera or Nebbiolo? I think it's Nebbiolo. I can never remember the second one. So Dad says, I haven't heard of either one of them. Then he said, Ruth, get a paper and write this down. So my mom had just finished putting on dinner and everything. She couldn't find a paper quickly enough. And so Daryl Cordy says, that's all right, Ruth. So he pulled out a dollar bill and he wrote Barbera and the other variety on it. And he gave it to my dad.
Uh-huh.
So then Dad says, well, okay. So what do you know about this Barbera? And I said, I think Gary got some. Gary is growing it down there. I talked to Gary and I said, I'm going to put in 5 acres of grapes. I'm thinking about Barbera. If we use your same clone, I'd like to sell them to you. Should we use your clone? He said, absolutely. He says, use what we've got. And then we know it's a known quantity.
So that's an Italian varietal originally?
Yeah. So.
And then did it go through the phylloxera? Had to come over here and get grafted to?
No, we knew. My dad, because of his schooling at Davis, knew about phylloxera. And he told me, he said, don't ever plant any own vines on their own roots, son, because you'll never have a vineyard if you do. And there was, phylloxera was first diagnosed right in this vineyard, right there, up there about 200 yards in 1947.
Yeah.
My dad knew what it was.
Wow.
He didn't want to go up there and say, hey, you've got phylloxera. You know, my dad's a little different than I am. I'd say, let's get a shovel and go look, but I think you've got phylloxera. But my dad called one of his professors from Davis, and they came up and identified it.
Wow.
And so and that's the beginning of the end of any old vineyard is the phylloxera.
It just can't survive.
Right? Can't do it, no. There's a chemical they've got now that you can put in the ground. But, I mean, it's not the Lord's Prayer. You know what I mean? It helps a little bit. But basically, it's like you're going to die. What kind of poison do you want?
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I mean, you're looking at... And you can bury your drip wine under the ground, and you can do this, you can do that. And that's because this Movento, some people feel like, well, I'll put my drip lines under the ground, and I can put Movento on whenever I want. And then most people just sprinkle it on with a... or spray it on with a sprayer. But then there was a problem with the Japanese government wouldn't do a baseline tolerance for Movento. So even though the material was out for 3 years, if your wine was going to go to Japan, you didn't want to use any grapes that had Movento in it, because even a trace could be picked up in the wine. And now that's been resolved. And then some people are playing with it and trying to keep old vineyards alive. But that's going to be the next bullet to bite in Shenandoah Valley, is who does what with these old vineyards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really need to be torn out and replanted, that's all. And then get up to 5 tons production or 4.5.
Yeah.
And with this other stuff, Movento, old vines plus Movento, maybe you get 3 on a good year. maybe you get 2.5.
Oh.
But 2.5, you don't make any money on 2.5. I mean, you're just going through the motions and for nothing.
So there seems to be a lot of new vineyards, but not much tearing out of the old ones and replanting them.
Yeah, you can see as you drive through, there'll be a pocket or half an acre of milk cartons out in a vineyard. That is the replanting of phylloxera. And people, you know, it's insidious because you don't realize it's taken so much away from you. Because here's the vines are green. Yeah, the canes aren't as long. Yeah, there's some fruit there. But like my friend Manuel from Fox Creek Ranch is Deke. There's so much phylloxera. When you're picking, you don't even stop the tractor. You just drive through.
Wow.
So, my dad's advice, I never planted anything on own roots.
To this day, still.
Right. Oh yeah.
So you've expanded the vineyard from 5 acres.
Yeah. You know, and then I planted some Zin, and I planted more Barbera, and then I got a chance to buy some Zin that was on the market, some vines that were on the market, and I bought them. I put them in the ground, and then I planted some more, and then I planted some more, and then I started thinking about this winery, and that's when I started planting some of the different varietals.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems like...
Because at the tasting room today, I think there were 6 different bottles, different choices.
Yeah, and there's more than that down in the barn.
Well, I realize, but still.
Yeah.
So
it's, you know what, Pat, it's just happened. I have a really good guidance system up here somewhere. I'm getting free advice from somewhere because I don't fly in the face of what I know is going to work or what I know is not going to work. Like Chardonnay, don't try and go Chardonnay here. It doesn't work in this climate. Don't try Cabernet. You won't like it, you know. And so I never did either one of those. But then when other things come along or somebody says, for instance, a salesman from Vinny's Nursery used to come by the one tour around every couple of weeks, and we'd open a bottle of wine and burn a couple of steaks. So I'd say, well, what's going on out in the world? This is what he means, what's going on out in the world. I said, I never get out there. What's going on in the state? He says, well, Gallo just bought 250,000 Pinot Grigio vines. I said, I'll take 1,000.
If they did the homework, then that's going to work.
Yeah, and then I had other people say, do you think that stuff's going to make acid? I don't think it's going to make acid. I said, I don't know. I have no idea. We'll know in a while. So I asked the guy from Montevigna, I said, I know you guys have that Pinot Grigio down there. How do you grow it? How do you culture it? He said, I don't know. We buy ours from Monterey County.
Not much help there.
So we've got ours out there. It's doing really good.
Uh-huh.
And Jerry Wright just had Fox Ranch 2 or 3 years ago, graft in probably 7 acres. They had some orange muscat or something that was not a favorable wine grape now.
Uh-huh.
You know, trends change.
Right.
Price change.
Yeah.
And he had them graft that 7 acres, and he takes it. So, I mean, he's selling a lot of Pinot Grigio.
And that's about as close to a Chardonnay type as you'll get. Vignier is a little drier, I think.
Yeah, I don't know how to compare them, really.
Yeah, and I was just asking for advice because I don't know.
It's probably a little fruitier and a little more whimsical than Chardonnay.
Where the Vignier is drier.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I think what's close to Chardonnay that we grow here is Sauvignon Blanc. And that's how we, you know, we don't... That was an idea I had a long time ago. Sauvignon Blanc, there was a lot of it planted in the late mid-70s. It was supposed to get you $1,300 a ton. Well, people call it the grape that never happened because it never came to that kind of money.
Never got that kind of production.
Never, no. Well, they could get production, but they couldn't sell it. It just didn't move. But at the time, there's a way they prepare it in Germany, where they throw a lot of leaves in the barrel with the wine, and it gets this vegetative taste to it, you know. And some people brought that in with the Sauvignon Blanc, but it just makes a ghastly wine. I mean, it's terrible. And so it has barnyard smells, you know, to it from that rotting leaves. And I told Frank Alviso one day, this is just where little ideas come from. I told Frank Alviso one day, so we were down at some bank deal, some bank reception in Sacramento, and they had some white wine there, and it was chilled, and we were having white wine, and Frank says, you know, Cooper, says, one thing about white wine, if it's cold, it's palatable. I said, you know, Frank, I said, I think that if people would just make Sauvignon Blanc just very crisp and flinty and mineral and treat it like Chardonnay, maybe just ferment in stainless steel or maybe French oak, but keep it dry. And I said, I think it would sell.
They get rid of the barnyard smell.
Yeah. And he says, he's talking, he says, quite so, Cooper. So that's how we make our Sauvignon Blanc. And I told Mike, same thing.
Have all oak barrels, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't see any stainless steel.
We've got some big stainless steel tanks that we hold in. And we ferment some grapes in them. But really, what it does is it just brings out the pure fruit, unadulterated, nothing else in it. It's the pure fruit. But you don't want to leave it on stainless for too long, because even though stainless steel is supposed to not impart any flavors, it makes wine taste a little crazy if you leave it in very long. You know, you don't want to store it in there. You want to process it, and then with a white, you want to get it in.
So those are down at the production building.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we could talk about wines forever. I know that's kind of your calling. But the tasting room came
10 years ago.
Was it 10 years ago now?
We're here 10.
Because you didn't have tasting at all. It was just a working ranch until then.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
We had some wines made for us at Windwalker. And because I had big ideas about, I want to start a winery so the kids will have something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the problem was when I'm going along on my winery program, I had a nice set of plans and everything drawn up, something twice as big as this. I had this spot picked out because it's always breezy. Feel how breezy it is up here?
Yeah.
It's always breezy. And then 9/11 happened. Kabang. I thought, what's going on in the world?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought, geez, you know, here I'm ready to drop, I don't know how much. We started off, we were going to spend $350,000 and ended up to what we wanted to build was $1 million because we started on it and had been working on it for 4 years or so. Well, after that, I just dropped that set of plans in the garbage can, said, okay, we're going to regroup. So we decided to build the smallest, most reasonable, attractive building that we could build on the site to make it look nice and not cheap, make it look quality, keep it small. I mean,
yeah, that back to the Disneyland
thing.
That's
right. That's right. Mr. Boger over there in Placerville, he's up until I think probably a couple of years ago, he served wine out of a 150-year-old adobe building built right on the creek in the pear orchard. you know, I went over there and saw that, and thank you. And I went over, and I had always been kind of enamored of this adobe building, you know. And I went over there. Here are these old pear trees left over from the pear industry over there in Placerville. You know, it's grapes all around it, but there's some pear trees. And here's a little, like about a 10 by 10 or 12 by 12 little sandbox with some little trucks in there for kids to play in, you know.
Oh, okay.
And people parking and getting out, and their kids running over and playing in the sand, and the people, and I thought, man, how humble is this?
Yeah,
you know, but it was so
genuine. Vogel Vineyards.
Not Vogel. That's down in the islands. I'll think of it in a second.
Well, you said Boger or something.
Boger. Yeah, Boger.
Yeah, I wasn't sure which one that was.
Yeah, no, Bogle's down there. Boger's over there, and Boger is on hills just like this. It looks like Grandma Moses. You know, he's a great guy. I had a really nice D2 Caterpillar and a hydraulic disc, and I knew I was never going to use it. And the last time I used it was when I came home and I had that prostate operation, and I went out 2 weeks after that, fired up that. I could only start it because it had self-start. And I that was when there was no vineyard down there in that 3.5 acres, and I, down the last you see past those walnut trees, and I
dissed, oh, okay.
I dissed that up. That was a something I wanted to do. I hurt so bad. I was half laying back in the seat with my feet up on the throttle and the dashboard, and it took me 20 minutes to get off of that tractor after I shut it down, but I did it.
Yeah.
But anyway, I gave him the tractor because he's a.
You can have this.
He's a. Yeah. He. You know, I put a tarp over it and I never used it for 5 or 6 years, so. I called him up one day and I said, I got a present for you. And he says, well, what's that? And I said, I got a D2 narrow gauge, excuse me, self-start with a 6.5 foot hydraulic disc on it. He says, well, what do you want for it? And I said, nothing. I said, I know you can use it over there with your hillside deal. Excuse me, besides he's a collector. I mean, he can open up every building. He'll open up building after building, and he's got Dodge pickups, 1927.
Never gets rid of anything, huh?
Yeah. He's collected that stuff. I mean, he takes stuff that the rest of us had push in a pile and cover up, you know.
On the way over here, I saw them three white Ford pickups out in the field. Well, I know I'm getting close to Cooper's.
Yep.
The various states of disrepair.
Yeah. So, so anyway, I built this thing here. I thought there's 2,500 square feet here. I thought we can do, the rule of thumb in this business is 2,500 square feet, 2,500 cases.
Okay.
Excuse me. I should have poured some of that.
No, that's fine.
2,500 square feet, 2,500 cases.
Okay.
And so I thought, this is all we're ever going to need. And then we just outgrew it.
Yeah.
The first wine we had made at another winery, I think we made wine for 3 years, and I sold it bulk to other wineries locally who were starting up but had been making wine in a double garage and found out they didn't have enough. And that, so they sampled mine, and I got an excellent price for it. I made money on it.
Uh-huh.
But I don't advise doing custom crush and thinking you're going to sell it and make money, because a lot of times you don't.
Uh-huh.
But we did, and that helped us build this, and then we built this, and then we ran out of space here, and then we built the building down the bottom of the hill, the production building. Now I'm thinking about building a barn, because it's a little scary. We have so much wine down there, and it's stacked so high. I know we're not in a seismic area, but I just there's too much in one spot down there. It's just
It's stuffed to the gills. Huh?
Yeah, and but we went through a thing for a while where my winemaker was not really, it was not his idea to bottle a lot of wine ahead, but we were always running out of wine at the bar. You know what I mean? Like Jerry was always nervous. Hey, I only have two reds on the bar and two whites. What's going on?
Yeah.
You know, so we
what are they doing down there?
Yeah. So we got ourselves kind of revamped, and now we're on top of the kind of the power curve. But we also, to help that out, we also bought a bigger press, and we made some improvements that makes it possible for the winemaker to get more wine out of there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just seems like every year that goes by, you have to spend $35,000 on something else. But I mean, that's okay. You know, if you're making it, and
yeah.
there isn't much that you can write off in this business either. You know, the winery business, you can write off your barrels, you can write off your help, you can write off the fruit you buy, and that's just about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got to come up to a break here for a minute, but I was going to ask you, we got other things to talk about, but tell me about the Stone Corral. That was the latest thing that was built, right? Was
yeah.
that last year or 2 years ago?
2 years ago.
Beautiful. I guess handsome would probably be a better word.
You know, now right down in that area where they have the Barbera Festival, that was a rock pile there, and it had blackberries growing in it. It was a wasted space. And what I did was, when I first inherited this place from my dad, I knew I had to do some dirt work, and I knew I had to do some rock removal. Like when I took 35 acres of prunes out here, there were several areas where the rocks, there was big rock piles. And like right in between, you couldn't even get through there you'd get through with a cat and a dozer, but there was only one place you could drive between here and there. Now you can drive between, you can have a Corvette show down there in the middle if you want to.
Right.
But that was just all chance ceilings of wild prunes. You know what I mean? It was just a mess. It was like,
yeah.
You know, it's like a Vietnamese jungle. And so anyway, I would hire a D8 whenever I could. And then I'd have them take out rocks here, take out rocks there, take out trees here, take out trees there. And while you're here, soften up that rock pile down there for me. What do you mean soften it up? Just loosen as much of it as you can, and when you can't move anything else, put the cat on the low bed and leave. So I did that every time I got a cat around here. Well, two things, good and bad. The bad is, whenever they came in, they left me a big plantation of Bermuda grass, you know, which came in on the tracks.
Yeah.
The good news is, they loosened up all that rock. And we started removing that rock. And then I decided I needed a little excavator. And that's, we removed the rock and removed the rock. And then the next time a D8 came through, we'd have them loosen it up some more. There was a big, down by my house, there was a big rock pile. And my...
It's worried that pile might be empty. That makes me nervous. I could feel it.
Are we drinking enough?
Now you will be.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we need anything else, Pat?
No, we got some water and a little wine. We're doing great.
We might spend the night.
Excellent. So good.
All right. Well, we're coming up to. We came up. We're coming up to a break.
You take your break.
Yeah. I got to tell you. All right, Michelle brought us some water and a little more wine, and we are back talking about, we stopped at the story about the rock pile that turned into the corral.
Yeah, the rocks, there's just an abundance of rocks on this farm, and in the old days, they didn't take the rock piles out, because the only way they had to move the rocks was black powder. They didn't have any big enough equipment, and so they just farmed around them.
Yeah, they were just part of the landscape.
Right. And if it was in the row, you just took out, you didn't plant trees, you didn't plant vines. And so then the blackberries came with the birds, and then they just ended up having, just being a terrible mess wherever they were. And so when I took out this 35 acres of prunes, there was like several big, huge rock piles out there, and we took them out, and that was another D8 deal, and there's only one rock left. And he dug round and round and round, Mervyn Vicini did, and I went out there and looked at it, and it looked like a huge gopher mound with nothing but black smoke coming out of it. I couldn't even see the tractor. It was down so low, and that rock kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Wow.
And he says, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Push the dirt back around it. We'll leave it in the vineyard, and we'll make it a monument to the pioneers."
Yeah.
And that's the only rock in that vineyard.
Is the only
that's the only rock, and it's big.
And it's down by the corral.
No, it's over. It's west of the corral.
Oh,
but anyway, there was in the corral area, there was a. That was a wasted space for a long time too, and so I had these D8s whenever I had big equipment, and then we took out a whole bunch of rocks from there and shoved them over there in a gully down past the production building, which wasn't there then, and then we kept throwing rocks over there. Well, then that just got to be a huge mess, and when we built the production building, we knew we had to get those rocks out of there. Because it's just you don't build something nice on top of a mess. We're getting back to the Disneyland deal.
Yeah, got to get the mess out of the
right.
way.
So, it took us a week to get those rocks out of that gully, which is an old mining ditch, you know. So then we put them back there in the area, the only flat area, which was over there at the round pen. Well, when I go to see my daughter in Sonora, a berg over there. I can't remember. Greeley Hill. There's a beautiful round pen at Jamestown. And I love old. I just love old. And some friends of mine went to a wedding at Duarte Brothers Winery. They used to have a nursery. They still do. But it's the Duarte Winery. They have an old mission that's built into a hill. It's somewhat like the Butte store.
Uh-huh.
And you can have weddings in there. But I'm not sure of the figures, but I think it costs $5,000 to have a wedding. And then plus, they take you up the hill to this, it looks like the Alamo. You know, it's a typical mission.
Deal. Yeah.
And it's half of it's fallen down. It's ruins, but it's very well maintained. They have these special events there. High end. And I thought, man, I've got enough rock. I could do a ruins like the Alamo down here, because
yeah.
I have enough rock. There must have been 10,000 tons of rock, because I've been collecting it, and it came from there.
Yeah.
And I thought, yeah, and I'll be fighting with the building department and the planning commission. You know, you can't build a wall, you can't build something over 4 feet high unless it's engineered. I thought, no ruins. And I thought, round pin. So I went down with my guys and I said, I've got an idea. Get some estacas, stakes. Get some paint. Bring one tape measure and one planting rope.
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of went down there, and I tried to assess where the center of gravity was in that area. You get so you can sense things. You know, you don't want to put it too far this way or too far that way.
Yeah.
Sense the center of gravity. I said, one long estaca, a key. Bang, 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 bang. I had this round circle, a steel circle. It's something that we got several of them war surplus, and when I was at the fair, we used to go to the war surplus and get stuff. And I brought this home, or it was in my tools or something. I've always kept that circle. So I took that circle, I put a non-stretchable line in there. We went out. I think I wanted something that was going to be 48 feet outside diameter. So we went to 48 feet, half of that, 24 feet, went out there and started driving stakes. And then
off that circle.
Off that circle. And we were on this rock pile. We couldn't even get stakes in some places. I told the guys, I said, just take your paint, make one mark so we know. You know, so we went all the way around and did these stakes. And then we moved some of that rock out of the way and so that we could see what we were doing. And then we put stakes every 6 or 8 feet all the way around there. You know, I say stakes are like these fence posts here with the...
Right, T-posts.
Yeah,
yeah.
And then we took a clothesline and we wrapped around and then we got the perfect thing. We tried level, but it was way too high at the bottom. And I'd have been 6 feet high with my... And there I am fighting with the building department. So, and then I went over on that hill and looked back down at it. And I went over there and looked at it. And it looked weird. And so I came over and I dropped down 2 increments here. We just did it. We just did it until it looked good. And then we built
it. And it fit the land.
Just fits the land, yeah.
Yeah.
Perfect.
That's that Disneyland.
Disneyland,
yeah. Yeah.
And then we made the doors. They're very primitive, but we made them in our own shop. And they're beautiful. And we just let the wood weather. And it's just, you know, people come and take high school pictures there. And there'll be people getting married there. And although my daughter doesn't care much for weddings here. But I'm going to take right away, I'm going to run a power line underground from the production building down the fence and back up over behind that. And so we'll have power available because some people want to do outdoor parties and they want a band and they want light and they want the cowboy thing. So all I have to do is spend $5,000 and get power down there.
Uh-huh.
And then we can do those parties. But it's basically, it's a round pen. It's what the Mexican vaqueros use, you know, only taller. Some people say, oh, my horse would jump right out of that. I said, well, maybe your horse would. I don't know. But it's right for us.
And we then still, you can go chasing.
And we still hauled 5,000 tons of rock.
So you only used half.
Wow. I don't know. It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, you mentioned two other subjects I wanted to talk to you about. One is, I know they're their pride and joy, and is your family and the girls and their involvement in here. And they all say they're just here to help Dad. That's what they tell me.
Yeah, thank God for them.
Yeah. Unfortunately, I did not know there were 4 of them here. I was just telling you until for a couple of days ago. Jennifer, who is the oldest, lives over in Sonora. But you said she comes and helps out some too?
Oh yeah, she does the special events and the cooking and in charge of the volunteers or in charge of the people we hire and procures the food, talks to the different people that supply food and we're trying to be as close to compliant to the county regs as we can. We don't offer food for money. You know, we give food away.
Mm-hmm.
And so we feel like we probably don't need to be, if you're going to do food for money, you have to have a dedicated well with a 50-foot concrete seal. So that means a separate, that's $50,000. And then you have to have a commercial kitchen. And even though we have a very nice kitchen down there in that building, it's not a commercial kitchen. And to be legal to charge for food, we would probably, you know, spend $100,000. Why? We don't sell food anyway. We're not here to sell food. I'm against selling food.
Okay.
So we give it away.
Mm-hmm.
And then like the Spaghetti Western, that's a cause. What is it? It's a,
yeah, for cancer research.
For cancer research, yeah. And then, of course, all the water we use is bottled water and la-da-da. So, I don't know. We're
and
just,
the food, a lot of the food gets donated for that Spaghetti Western, too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
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 That's what I thought.
You have to be careful, though. You have to know kind of like the chain of custody of food because you really have to know, I mean, if it's rice spaghetti and you boil it or the ag commissioner comes and he's so good. Not Onetto, another Italian boy.
It's not Scott Onetto?
No, it's another, the guy who's the ag commissioner.
Yeah.
In this county. I'll think of it in a minute. Anyway, yeah. He's got a huge spaghetti cooking deal. So, you know,
he takes care of that.
He takes care of that, and you know it's sterile, and you know it's done right. I mean, it's not, when we feed 600 people like that, it's not like a potluck. I mean,
yeah.
You know,
it, we not just, like one you'd go down to the schoolhouse for.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And you know what? Nobody ever gets sick anyway.
So Jennifer's the oldest, and then
Rochelle.
I don't want let you tell me. I don't want them to get mad at me. For
oh yeah. Well, no, Rochelle. You know, Rochelle has grown into.
She was gone for quite a while.
She was doing her own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not gone, but just doing her own thing. And I told her, I said, honey, I said, you know what? We don't have any advertising program. I know you're artistic as can be. I just wish you'd put together an advertising program for this winery. You know, and I said, I just wish you, I'm charging you with that, if you'll accept that responsibility. And so she kind of started kind of slow, and but now she's caught on. She's taken some courses in advertising art, you know. The dispatch has been really, really helpful to her. And when they've had some experts over there from time to time that she's gone over and talked to. And she's just, so everything you see advertising us is all Rochelle.
In-house by her.
I don't tell her what to write. I just give her a great big, I love it, thank you very much for what she does. And she does well. I mean, the things you see. You know, that color, the pictures she takes. And also Chrissy, the baby, has an excellent eye.
Yeah.
You know, so between the two of them, and then Jerry, she's taking pictures too.
Right, Jerry
she's
would be the next one in line.
Yeah, Jerry, yeah. And she took over this wine, the management of this building. When Chrissy got this thing up and flying, but then
when she was still single, though.
When she was still single,
yeah.
And no family,
right?
And then along comes the marriage, and then the family, and then she had an actual opportunity to make more money at a back in the legal business, which she was schooled for, and she went there, but for some reason or other, it didn't work out, and she had Cooper. Cooper came along and she moved. Anyway, long story short, Jerry Ellen stepped in and took over this place. And previously, Jerry had been helping me in the field. You know, every day she was out there. But when it came time for her to take over here, she stepped right up. And she has her own ideas. They were different from Chrissy, but not bad. They were good ideas. So that's, and she is just done a real fine job right here, mm-hmm. You know, doing that.
I'm smiling because the three I know, they all have their own ideas.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I mean that in the kindest way. So, and Chrissy just came back and moved into another old, I read it too, and I can't remember, another ranch.
Her grandma's ranch?
Her grandmother,
Greelich ranch.
Was Greelich, yeah.
Yeah, Chrissy, Grandma Greelich, Eleanor Greelich, left her. There was a trust, and I believe, and half of it was distributed. Half of it was bequeathed by the father, George Greelich. And then when Eleanor Greelich passed on, she left her part to Chrissy. And Chrissy's doing a really nice job with that old home down there. They're going to fix it up. They're going to put their house up for sale in Durham, and they're going to move down and really fix that old home up. And it's just really a nice place, but it's probably 100 years old, and it requires better foundation here and there, and a septic system, and all the things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm so happy because they're going to be close. And
there's, what, two or three little ones?
Two. The eldest is Cooper. She's 5.
I mean, they're really small.
They're small. And then the next one is Peyton, and she's 2.5. And she's a pistol. Oh, gosh. She's just she's just going 100 miles an hour. And Cooper's kind of like thinks more, very articulate, and talks. She talks like an adult, you know. That one does.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just love them, and it's just... It's such a neat thing to me to have them so close.
Puts the vitality back in this whole operation.
Oh, yeah.
Every time they show up, I'll bet.
Yeah. And when Cooper comes up to the tasting room, she says, I want to go see Aunt Jerry. So she goes up to see Jerry. You know, she walks in.
Uh-huh.
When I used to go to my grandfather's house in Amador, in Calaveras County, I was afraid of it because it was dark. He had a hallway that was dark. I wouldn't go down it. You know what I mean? It's one of those old things where there was a bedroom here and a bedroom here and a bathroom here and a bathroom.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't go in it. But Cooper comes up here and she's, hi, everybody. How's everything? You know? And she just is a friend of all. And I just love it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I have another granddaughter that I didn't mention. Jennifer has a daughter named Rosie. And she worked here all last summer behind the bar. 18 years old. You can work behind a bar at 18, but you can't drink. You don't can't drink, but you can pour.
Okay.
And so she came and was here all last year and developed her own fan base, and she's going to work here again this year. And she goes to University of California, San Diego. And then Marcus, I've got a grandson. He's Jerry's son, and he lives in New York. And I don't think he's ever going to come back except to visit because he loves those tall buildings.
He does.
You know, he just loves it. And then Eric, my grandson, his brother, just got accepted to University of California at Davis. So that's three of the family, my dad, myself. And
three generations,
yeah.
Wow.
Going to Davis. And he's taking food science, I think. So... he'll be, when he comes out of there, he'll be able to make wine or do whatever he wants to do, really. I don't put any pressure on anybody to do anything.
But he's shown some interest in what you're doing?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mainly, he keeps our computers up.
Oh. Very important. He does what his mother tells him to do. All right. Well, that's pretty much the family. We skipped over a very important thing, though, that I've... Before I even knew you, you used to play, your band played on Saturday nights at the fair, if I remember right. And your band, though, started way back in high school. I know you love music, and you love to sing and play guitar, so kind of tell us how that all started.
Oh, Bab Verdugo.
Because I can play a radio. That's about my musical talent, so I'm very impressed.
Bab Verdugo, he's a real California vaquero, legendary. I used to go down to the Celio Ranch, that's over on off Union Mine Road, and I used to go down there.
Oh, El Dorado?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there was a big ranch house there, it burned down. And ride horses. And of course, I was not a horse rider, and I always wish I could ride a horse.
There's your horse, right?
That's my horse. But anyway, he gave me this guitar, and it had a baling wire over the neck, down underneath the body of the guitar over here because the neck was broken. But you could still make chords. So he gave me that guitar, and he showed me some chords. So I knew three chords, and then I knew four, and then I knew five, and then I learned six, and then I could sing Home on the Range and all that kind of stuff. And that was when I was about eighth grade.
So it goes way back to even before high school.
Yeah, yeah. Then I went to the FFA, National Convention, in Kansas City, Missouri. And I went, and that was my senior year in high school. And I was just out walking around one morning with a couple of buddies of mine, and we came to this pawn shop, and there was this K guitar in there, and it was the most beautiful guitar I ever saw, you know. And I think it was something like $27 or $30 or something. And I had to have it, but I only had $30. And so what I did was, I bought the guitar, and I knew I had to live 3 days on nothing. And I think maybe I had $2 or something. So I bought the guitar, and on the way back to the room, I bought a loaf of French bread and a pound of butter.
To keep yourself alive.
Keep myself alive.
For 3 days.
So the next morning, we all get on the train. I get on the train with my bag and my guitar and my butter and my... And so then when everybody else would say, okay, we're going to go to the dining car and have breakfast, I'd say, no, you guys go ahead, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so I'd just break out my butter and my bread and eat it. And so the porter told me, he says, if you'd like to keep your butter in the water cooler, you can do it. So he showed me. So I stashed my butter in this water cooler at the end of the train, at the end of the car, you know, where they... So that's how I got home. I just made it home with that guitar. And then I used that guitar and I added electrics to it. And I got together with another guitar player builder in River Pines. And then he gave me a homemade guitar that I played for a long time. And then I got a job. I was in some high school productions too, you know, and stuff. Elvis Presley was big then. And those girls that say, come on, Dick, we're going to make your hair black. So they'd put mascara in my hair and all that stuff. And I'd get out and pretend I was Elvis Presley, and all the girls would scream and cry. You know, I didn't know how lucky I was. But anyway, this other guitar player kind of lined me up with this homemade guitar, and I went to work. The day after I was 21, I went to work at Barry's Fountain and Grill in Mount Ockham for $5 a night, playing music with another kid. He got $5 a night. I had my homemade guitar, no microphone. We just stood up there and sang. And then we got a microphone. And then we got a bass player. And then the good news about that up there was Wetzel Oviatt Sawmill was going real strong then.
Mm-hmm.
And so all those people, they came to Otten Verna Berry's place on Saturday night, or Friday and Saturday night. And so they passed the hat around. We take a break at 10 o'clock. Bobby Godala passed the hat around. Here comes $27 in the kitty. Wow.
Boy.
We're making $5 a piece a night and we get $27 in the kitty.
Wow.
And that lasted, and that lasted real good until they had that wood strike. They had a strike up there and shut the whole mill down, and it was never the same. I mean, there was never as much money. I think they calculated that everybody would have to live to be 120 to make the money that they lost just from the strike.
Yeah.
But that's where we started, Bobby Benningfield. I started playing music with him on his... I went up to his wedding reception. It was after they were married, and I took my guitar, and his wife said, bring y'all guitar. So I brought my guitar, and Bobby, and we played. Everybody else left, including her. And Bobby and I ended up playing music, you know, together. And then he's still my buddy, and he still comes up here. He's going to be here. I just went down to a jam session he had in Stockton, and
maybe that's
he'll be here at this
time. You invited me one time to a party, and you played. It was because it was winter. You guys were inside. And you said, this is the guy I've been playing music with for 50 years.
Yeah.
And I didn't remember his name, but that had to be. He's a guitar player, too.
Yeah. So, you know, I made a lot of money playing music. Not to get rich, but to buy groceries. I bought lots of groceries with my money. I mean, you know, ultimately I got to be like, play someplace Friday night for $25, play someplace Saturday night for $50, go down to Plymouth Hotel, make $15 in the kitty, add that up.
Yeah.
You know, 30, 40 years ago, I bought groceries.
A little walking around money, too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, is there anything maybe? Well, I did want to go over the Barbera Festival. I said you're the king of Barbera. Was that your idea to host one of the premier events in Northern California?
No, you know,
for people who haven't heard of it, it's the tickets. There's 1,800 tickets, and it sells out in 8 to 10 days.
You know what? It's just one of those things where it came along. Brian Miller and Muller and Deidre Miller, if I got those right, I get Muller and Miller mixed up.
Yeah.
It was their idea, and they came up with it. And do we want to do it? And we said, yeah. And I think our grounds were a little rough the first year. We smoothed them out the second year. And I think this is the fourth year, isn't it? This is the fourth, mm-hmm. the third. I think we're on target now. We've had to change the way we take care of the soil surface in that walnut orchard. We have to provide grass, and normally we would disc, and so what would
which
be there
is what it used
would
to be
dirt. Yeah.
Yeah, where you park, past the production. Is that the orchard you're talking about?
Yeah. So it requires
monumental
more. There's I've got one guy working there almost every day down there making it nice, but it gets back to the Disneyland thing. You want to see green grass, you want to see green trees, you want to see it clean. You don't want to see a single. You don't even want to see a gum wrapper on the ground.
And
you don't want to see tracks in the mud.
Right.
You know what I mean?
And you get out of your car, and here comes the people mover behind the tractor, and it's clean. And
yeah.
I mean, you told me you were trying to get another one built.
Yeah,
before.
We are. I think we'll do it.
You think you'll make it?
Yeah.
So you don't even have to walk, even if the ground is a little uneven. The tractor and the
very
people
little walking required.
Care.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, you know what? Those people put in a lot of effort, and we put in a lot of effort, and it's just a day in the life where it just goes wham. It's like a near miss with a comet. And when it's over, it's all done, and everybody says, wow, what was that?
Yeah. Boy, we had fun, did we?
Yeah.
Well, I also have heard, everyone tells me that, and this is just facts, not any, or to build up your ego, that if you have a broken tractor, if you're new to the business, my friend from Andis Wines, Andy,
yeah,
said he was here in today about 2 days, and you called him on the phone. Next day you went to see him and gave him that story, kind of like what your father told, don't do this, do that, it'll be okay. That you help all of these other guys who are in actuality, they're your competitors. But you're just known for, the tractor's broke down, call Dick Cooper. He'll come and help us.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing to be known for, my friend. I don't know if you even have a comment on that. But
My dad, when Frank Alviso and John Hahn first came to town, they bought that piece of ground over by the cemetery. And they were having troubles. I mean, they were planting green growing bench grass, which are like little tomato sets, in July, instead of having an irrigation system with the drip line running down every row, they had one drip line here, and then they'd throw it across the row to the other side. Terrible idea. And their vineyard was dying, and it was full of tall grass. And my dad says, do they have a decent disc over there or not? You know, I said, no, they don't. They got a Ford tractor, which I ultimately overhauled for Frank. I said, they have a Ford tractor with a little cracker box disc, and it's not set up right, and they don't have it set right. And he said, well, why don't you take over? He said, do they have a D2? And I said, I think they do, but they don't pull anything with it. He says, take over our desk. We're done with it, aren't we? That's when I was helping him run that ranch and this ranch, too. I said, yeah, we're done with it. Take it over to them and get them started with it. Okay, so I go over there. I said, Frank, I said, my dad wants to send a disc over to you. And all he needs is a D2. Do you have one? Yes, we do. I said, good.
Does it run?
So, anyway, I took it over there, And they dissed their grass. They got rid of the competition. And they got rid of my dad's favorite rocks that were on that disc. Oh, my God. He had these perfect rocks, you know, for weight. I don't know what they hit, but they came
launched
back without the rocks. Oh, my God. But anyway, then that was kind of the start of it. And it's just like, it's easy to help somebody if they need the help and will accept it. You can offer. And if you can help somebody, why not? Howard Kirkland helped me when I got started. I was my big entrance to farming was I leased this ranch next door because I had ideas I wanted to try, but my dad didn't want to try them here. So I leased that little place over there, and that was post-drought. Remember the drought in 70, what would it be, five or six? You know, I took this thing over and the walnut trees and everything, and I got it built back up. Well, Howard Kirkland loaned me a little 4-day-end tractor. And I was just, and it wouldn't run for very long because it was an old model and it has a distributor down in the bottom in the front. It just runs right off the cam gear, I guess, like a 40 Ford. Well, anyway, you could run it, but then after it had a bad seal and it would get oil in there in the distributor, and after you ran it for an hour and a half or two, then it would stop. So then you had to let it sit all night long and drain back, the oil drain back away. You could start it again,
yep,
and run it. But there you go. Howard loaned me that tractor, and I remember I was putting brakes on it once. It didn't have very good brakes. So, and I had it, I had a big boom truck. I still have it. It was an antique boom truck, and it hasn't run in 25 years. But anyway, so I had the... I picked it up. I wanted it out of the way. So I just ran it up in the air, this tractor, and turned the boom truck off and just left this tractor up there. And I think we had some people for dinner something that night or a picnic or something. And Howard came over and he looked up there and here's his tractor, no tires, no wheels, just up there 12 feet off the ground. What are you doing with my tractor?
Well, I can hear him, yeah.
I said, Howard just needed brakes. Getting brakes this week. Howard helped me. He just loaned me that. People have given me brakes. Jack Crane comes over, and if there's a vine out here that needs to be grafted, here's Jack Crane's old 62 truck, you know, 62 Chevy. He knows this ranch because he used to farm it for his aunt, Norma Ball. And so here's Jack Crane out there. I don't even go out and bother him. I just know that's what he's doing.
He's
grafting a vine for me.
Yeah.
You know, and I wouldn't have a ranch if it wasn't for the likes of Jack Crane.
Wow, yeah.
So I think he and I are the two old school farmers left in Shenandoah Valley. You know, we know the reasons why. And I wrote a book to try and tell people what the reasons why are. And he wrote a book, too, about harvesting prunes in Shenandoah Valley. Still there.
Huh. All right. Well, Dick, I really appreciate lunch and your time. And I learned a lot. Even though I thought I knew you pretty well, I learned quite a bit. And you're a great Amadorian, and I don't think there's any higher praise than that.
Well, I agree. It's just wonderful to live here and be here. And the folks here are just exceptional.
Yeah.
You know, like two people I know, Mr. Chris Upton, who was my science teacher in high school. He's from the Uptons from Shenandoah Valley. He's a rifle shot due west from here, his ranch. And I didn't go they dedicated the marker up here at Four Corners to the pioneers.
Oh, okay.
You know, it's right up there at the end. It's past the flower farm.
Oh,
and a white spotted road. And I remember when they had that dedication, you know, I wanted to go, but you know what? I was pulling a tractor. I had my low bed on, and I was pulling a tractor and a disc to some other farm, you know, and I thought, oh, I wish I could go and stand there. There was about 50 people there. But I read the text of his presentation, and he used to do like Jack Benny. He'd... thoughtful, and he'd do this.
Thinking it over.
He'd say, you know, I'm not worried about dying and going to heaven because I'm in Shenandoah Valley and that's heaven now. And that's how he ended his talk. I read it in the paper. You don't have it.
Uh-huh.
Another gentleman I know that I just have tremendous amount of respect for. A hard-working man in Amador County. He's just a dedicated guy. And he told me once, he said, and he's closer to the end of his life than I am. He said, I really hate to leave because it's so beautiful.
Yeah. It is beautiful.
So with that thought, folks, we'll leave you. Again, thank you, Dick Cooper's The Life and Times of the Cooper Family in Amador County.
Thanks, Pat.
Thank you.